Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Soshi Talks. Today, Wittenberg University professor Tammy Proctor speaks about the myth of the female spy. You'll hear about an art exhibit featuring the works of military veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Up first, three local newspapers will be shut down as of August 9th, the Springboro Sun, the Kettering Oakwood Times, and the Centerville Washington Township Times. Michael Bush, CEO with Civitas Media, the company that owns the paper, said in a statement that the newspapers no longer fit their business model of providing news and information to predominantly rural areas. Bush also says the 12 employees affected by the closings have been offered other employment. Adam Hughes with the Springboro Chamber of Commerce says the Springboro Sun was highly valued by their organization.
It's a great tool for us to inform the community about news of the chamber. And with that paper going out, it's a big blow to us. It's one of the tools that we use for our members to kind of promote any events or anything new going on at their business.
According to Hughes, in just the last year, the Sun newspaper went from being a free publication to costing a dollar. That may have cost them some readership. He also believes the closings are a part of the changing media landscape. Springboro residents still have access to one other free publication, the Star Press from Miller Publishing. Civitas Media out of North Carolina still has more than 100 publications across 11 states. Ohio jobs numbers were released this week, and to get a picture of what happened in June, we've got Ben Johnson with the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services on the line. So job numbers out for Ohio on Thursday. Let's talk about those.
Ohio's unemployment rate was 7.2% in June. That's up from 7% in May. The state lost 12,500 jobs. There were a couple of things that were noticeable about the June report. The first is that the unemployment rate, the survey that generates the unemployment rate, showed a modest decrease in employment. It showed a decrease of about 2,000 working Ohioans. It showed a larger increase in the size of the labor force. 6,000 more Ohioans were looking for work or working. And that brings the growth in the labor force to 27,000 since December. This comes after months and months and really years of a declining labor force. This is the one positive thing in the report. We've been waiting for the labor force to grow. We have signs now over the first 6 months of 2013 that it is growing. And we know that as people regain their confidence and come back into the labor force, it will temporarily drive up the unemployment rate. The other thing that's noteworthy about the June report is the volatility coming from the business survey. That's the survey that gives us total non-agricultural employment, and that's the survey that showed 12,500 fewer jobs. This is not the first time in 2013 that Ohio has seen a month of large increases. Last month in May, the state added more than 30,000 jobs, followed by a month of sizable decreases. The survey is swinging very widely right now, and we don't know exactly why. We do know that Ohio is not the only state where this is happening, that there are a lot of states where the numbers are just particularly volatile this year, and it may be some time. We may need some more data before we know exactly what that volatility means.
Even when the jobless numbers are, or the unemployment rate is trending down, isn't there also some negative aspect to the idea that the government doesn't count people as unemployed unless they're actively looking for work? So people who have stopped looking are a number that might be hard to assess, but it's there.
Right. So the way we track that, this phenomenon that the media often refers to as, or this group of people, I should say, that the media often refers to as discouraged workers, although it's important from our perspective to note that we don't know why people leave the labor force. We just know that they left. But we track that discouraged worker phenomena through the size of the civilian labor force, which is a count of everyone who is working or looking for work. And you're exactly right. If you have not actively searched for a job in the last 4 weeks, you are not counted as unemployed. And so that's part of the reason that is the reason that we've been waiting to see the labor force grow, and that the increase in unemployment is not as negative as it seems. Now, I don't want to discount the fact that the survey showed there were fewer people working. That was certainly a factor as well. But the larger number is the growth in the labor force, 6,000 more people looking for work. It's in a lot of ways similar to consumer confidence. It's a sign that people are regaining confidence in the job market. They think that there's a job for them in their community, and so they've gotten back out there and started applying for jobs again.
So Ohio's numbers have consistently been below the national average. What do you attribute that to?
Well, the recovery in Ohio has come from a lot of different sectors, and that's I don't know if that's unique to Ohio, but when we look at the recovery, that's what's immediately noticeable. If you look over the last 12 or 24 months, the state has gained jobs in manufacturing, in retail, in leisure and hospitality, professional and business services. In most of the sectors, healthcare is a very important one that I didn't mention. In most of the sectors, when you look through the survey, employment is gradually increasing. Now it's happening slowly, but the fact that the recovery has been broad-based may be one reason that it's happened faster in Ohio than in other parts of the country.
Let's look ahead into the fall. What trends typically happen with job numbers in the fall as maybe college students go back to school and leave their jobs? Anything that we might see differently this fall?
Well, it's hard to say, and it's especially hard to say in light of the volatility that we've seen in the first 6 months of 2013. Our outlook remains largely unchanged, and the outlook of the economists that we listen to is also mostly unchanged. It's that the economy is improving, but it's happening slowly, and inherent in a slow recovery will be some months where the state takes a step or a half of a step backwards. We saw that here in June, although there was at least one bright spot in the report. So I think that in general the trend will continue, and it will be a trend of slow recovery, of people slowly getting back to work. But considering the recent volatility, it's really difficult to say what we might see in any given month.
Ben Johnson with the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And next on WISO Weekend, Politics Ohio with Emily McCord.
The Democratic challenger to Governor Kasich made a stop in Dayton this week. Cuyahoga County Executive Ed Fitzgerald held a roundtable discussion with area residents to talk about women's issues and the state budget. Ohio Public Radio's Karen Kassler joins me in the studio to talk about his campaign. Thanks for being here.
No problem. Glad to be here.
One thing Fitzgerald talked about while he was here was this initiated statute that could be used to get rid of parts of the budget, like the cuts to Planned Parenthood and restrictions to abortion. How would that work?
Well, first of all, a citizen-initiated statute is not unusual. We've seen it in the last couple of years. You might remember the smoking ban that passed. What happens is a number of signatures are gathered, then the legislation goes to the legislature, the General Assembly. They have an opportunity to vote on it. If they choose not to vote on it, then it goes to the voters. And that's exactly what happened with the smoking ban. With the budget and items in the budget, you can't take items that are directly related to appropriations and put them up for voters to decide, but you can take policy-related issues, such as limits on abortion. The Planned Parenthood stuff may not be able to be taken to the voters, but certainly the other things that involve abortion restrictions and that sort of stuff. And that's what Ed Fitzgerald is talking about doing. You need about 100,000 signatures, so it's going to take a pretty big effort. In fact, he's even said it's going to take an effort kind of like what was involved to bring the overturn of Senate Bill 5, the collective bargaining reform law. It's going to take that kind of an effort to bring this to the ballot next year. So that's a lot of people involved.
And of course, the timing of it, that would be on the ballot at the same time that Fitzgerald would be potentially facing off against Governor Kasich. So
yeah, not an accident.
Right. How does this play into his campaign, these women's issues?
Well, certainly that's exactly what Democrats have been talking about from the time this budget was signed, even before, even as these things that were eventually put into the budget were being talked about. You're seeing a lot of a picture that I took, that I tweeted out the night of the budget signing, that had Governor Kasich with six other people who were involved in the budget process, four Republicans who are on the conference committee, the Senate president and the budget director, all men standing behind him. Democrats have really been using that a lot to try to bolster their argument argument that the budget does a disservice to women and that men were the ones who helped put it together. And so these ideas of women's issues, it's a continuation of the war on women that we heard about during the 2012 presidential campaign, the so-called war on women, and also, you know, a continuation of arguments that have been happening here in Ohio with regard to restrictions on abortion.
One thing that Fitzgerald took issue in Dayton with was the idea of the state actually being in a strong financial position. Here he is talking about the state budget that was just passed.
The state budget is bigger than it's ever been. Now, I guarantee you that here in the Dayton area, most local budgets, whether it's a family budget or a government budget, are not bigger than they've ever been. So the state budget raises taxes on almost everybody, takes money away from local communities, and it's a bigger budget than it's ever been. They're still not living within their means.
Karen, is there truth to that?
Well, there's a lot of criticism on both sides of the fence with regard to that. This is a $62 billion budget, and you could make the argument that it is the largest spending document ever put together in Ohio. You could also make the argument it's one of the largest documents ever put together. It's 3,200 pages, something like that. For our TV show, The State of Ohio, I talked to two budget gurus back from the 1980s, and they talked about how their budgets were around 800 pages. So you compare the document size as well as the scope and some of the things that it does. And, you know, a lot of the argument about the budget has been that there's a lot of policy in it. There are a lot of big changes in it that have nothing to do with spending. And that's what a lot of the Democratic argument has been. And even some Republicans have said that they're very concerned about all the policy that's thrown in, policy that may not have gotten a lot of debate, but also a lot of the spending. That you have conservative groups who are saying the spending is unsustainable and that the state needs to get a better handle on that. So that idea of the size of the document in terms of what it encompasses, as well as the spending, are being debated. That's being debated on both sides of the Republican and Democratic spectrum.
Governor Kasich's approval rating has been improving. He's governor at a time when the economy is also improving. What does Fitzgerald have to do to convince Ohioans to change horses midstream?
A lot. Typically, the person who is in charge when the economy is doing well tends to do well when it's time to put them on the ballot. Right now, Governor Kasich's approval rating is at a record high, 54% approval rating in the Quinnipiac poll in June compared to 32% not approving. That's a huge, huge turnaround. He had a low of about 30% in January of 2011. And Ed Fitzgerald has a lot of ground to make up. The Quinnipiac poll in June also said that if the election were being held today, who would you vote for? 33% said Fitzgerald, 47% said Kasich. Now, it's not an insurmountable amount. Ted Strickland was leading going into the election of 2010, and John Kasich beat him. So things could happen. A lot of things could change in between now and the election of November of 2014. But certainly Ed Fitzgerald has a lot of work ahead of him.
I've been speaking with Karen Kassler from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here. Have a great weekend.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. On Friday, July 26th and Saturday, July 27th, Antioch College will host a series of free writing and art workshops for veterans and local allies. The workshops will be facilitated by Lavella Calica, founder of Warrior Writers, an organization that fosters artistic expression through workshops and retreats for veterans. They're part of a collaboration with the Herndon Gallery, their latest exhibit, Coming Home, which presents visual art and written works from recent military veterans, co-curated by Antioch College alumni Denny Eagleson. Denny joins us in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about your association with Herndon Gallery and Antioch College.
I am a graduate of Antioch College, and I started teaching photography at Antioch in 1988 as an adjunct, and then became a full-time tenured professor and taught there for 20 years until the college closed in 2008. I was invited back a year and a half ago to become the creative director of the Herndon Gallery, which is a really thrilling opportunity for me. I had been a gallery director when I was teaching in a half-time position. And it's a beautiful space. And because we are small, we are somewhat known as progressive, we can take a few more risks and experiment in ways that other galleries might not be able to. So it's been a great run. It's really been fun.
Well, let's talk about the exhibit Coming Home and everything that's involved here.
We were interested in this work, some because I have a friendship with Lynn Esteman, who is an Antioch graduate also, and she teaches new media in Pennsylvania. And she's been working with Warrior Writers for the last few years, and I knew of her work, and she recently completed a film that's called Out of Step. We wanted to have an exhibition that would be a backdrop for the Antioch reunion, whose theme was Antioch Writers. And I thought it would be interesting to have writers who were talking about experiences that we were not as familiar with, that may be more difficult stories. And so we worked with Warrior Writers, we worked with Combat Paper, we worked with young veterans. One is named Aaron Hughes, and another who is named Ash Keery. Aaron and Ash created an installation for the gallery that includes life-size emperor penguins, a family of them, and they appear to be flying kites. They're made out of ceramic, salt-fired ceramic. And they think that they're flying kites, but they're actually flying drones that are attached to the ceiling of the gallery. And Aaron Hughes created a large charcoal installation on the back wall of the gallery that is projected in the shape of drones, but what it is the text of stories of people who are drone pilots and people who have experienced drone attacks. And so it's sort of the statement of the disconnect that drone pilots have of watching their subjects playing with their families and then having to treat them as targets and eliminate them and then leave them and go pick up their own kids from their preschool and go back and be with their families. And that there is very high rates of PTSD with people who are asked to be drone pilots as well. And also it addresses the concern that this war is happening kind of secretly and that everyone's relieved that we're not losing soldiers' lives, but there are a lot of civilian lives of other countries that are being impacted by this. And when we need to be able to talk openly about what the implications of these are and what the consequences are.
Coming Home features works by veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and certainly those situations have been tragic for people on both sides of the conflict. But for military veterans, those experiences, as you said, can be quite traumatic. And I want to talk about Warrior Writers and the act of writing and the therapeutic aspects of what that can do.
Right. Warrior Writers is a really wonderful organization. And what they do is organize workshops. Some are specifically for veterans so that they create a safe place for veterans to process their experience. And people don't have to be like comfortable writing, but they learn how to name their experience, to put it into a form. They don't have to be accomplished poets. It's about coming in, sharing your experience, finding a community of other people who are struggling with the same kind of issues, the same kind of feeling of invisibility and disconnect, and trying to reconcile the acts that they were asked to do as warriors with living in the United States without much acknowledgement of what that sacrifice was or meant. And so this weekend workshop is, there is an sort of Working with Veterans 101 that we'll work with civilians. We're hoping that Antioch students and area community members come and participate in that. And what it will do is help sensitize people to veterans' issues, you know, what the effects of PTSD are, what their experience is. And after you've taken that introductory workshop, then you're free to participate in open arts and writing workshops. And so there are a series of workshops. Some are open, some are closed to vets only. But the whole weekend is meant to sort of create spaces for people to explore their experience, to translate it in both art and writing forms. And it will culminate in a Saturday evening performance in the Herndon Gallery at 7:30. I would like to invite, you know, people to come and be an audience for that and to hear these stories, to receive these stories.
And What kind of direct response have you had from vets who may have gone through this process, or if not, what is your understanding of their response of going through these workshops?
The evidence is on Warrior Writers' website. There are numbers of young veterans, their art and their writing and performance that you could see. It's very powerful. It's very moving. And it has been transformative for them. And, you know, people, I think, when they came back, were really isolated. They didn't know how to talk about the work, about what they did. They didn't know who would listen. And to find a community of people who were struggling together to find their humanity was really powerful. And so this weekend, also, Warrior Writers and Lavella Calica is hoping to train other people to become facilitators so that the writing circles for veterans spreads out to other cities, and the opportunity for people to come together and meet and write becomes more widespread and more accessible for people.
And our listeners can view those performances and look at some of the art at warriorwriters.org. I want to make sure that we've covered everything that's part of the Coming Home exhibit. We have the workshops, also the art installation pieces that are on view in the Herndon Gallery, and this exhibit has been open for some time.
Yes, and it's going to be open until August 16th. It's open from Tuesday through Saturday afternoon from 1 to 4. If people need to make arrangements to come at a different time, like I would invite groups of veterans who are, you know, working and meeting together, if they would like to come and visit the exhibition, but the times don't work, just to contact me, deeagleson@antiochcollege.org, and, you know, come and look at the exhibition. Come and participate in the writing workshops this weekend. Send me an email to let me know that you have the intention. Then we can know how to accommodate your needs and plan for you. And do come to the performance that's happening on Saturday night.
Again, that's July 27th at 7:30 p.m. in the Herndon Gallery. And Denny Eagleson of Antioch College and the Herndon Gallery, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Jerry.
So She Talks is a collaboration with the Southwest Ohio Council for Higher Education. Once a month, we bring Miami Valley research and thinking into the public arena, a way to enlighten the world with local knowledge. This week, Wittenberg University professor Tammy Proctor speaks about the myth of the female spy.
In our 21st century world, which national security depends heavily on solid, specific intelligence, the organizations that gather and analyze information about internal and external threats are crucial actors on the global scene. The personnel within those agencies work under extreme secrecy and often face the dual challenge of processing vast amounts of information under time-sensitive demands. While women comprise between 40 and 50% of the workforce in intelligence services, such as Britain's MI5 and Australia's Secret Intelligence Service, they still often find themselves confined to desks, working in clerical occupations, or otherwise stuck in low-paid positions within the organizations. My work investigates the origins of women's involvement in permanent intelligence agencies in the early 20th century. Between the formal creation of the Permanent Secret Service Bureau in 1909 and the end of World War I, more than 6,000 women served in either civil or military occupations as members of the British intelligence community. These women performed a variety of services, and they represented an astonishing diversity of nationality, age, and class. From 16-year-old English Girl Scouts at MI5 counter-espionage headquarters to octogenarian Belgian grandmothers, women enabled the government to develop a modern professional intelligence service. In fact, the operation of large-scale intelligence during World War I was absolutely dependent upon the availability of women workers, yet these women were in a paradoxical position. Barred from voting and holding political office, they could not even hold a permanent civil service job if they were married. However, they were being entrusted with state secrets and national security issues. Both men and women had been involved in information gathering prior to World War I, but intelligence did not assume its modern form until it had been shaped by the events of 1914 to 1918. With the advent of a total war and increased surveillance and control of populations, the British government increasingly relied on women to help staff their burgeoning bureaucracies. World War I witnessed the defining of espionage by media and government sources as an internal threat, and wartime trials tied the so-called enemy within to foreigners and to sexual deviance, often associating internal enemies with women. So as foreign women were arrested or deported, English women staffed the surveillance operations that the government used to track subversive activity. In the theaters of war, women were hired to provide human intelligence in occupied zones and frontline areas, some of them taking terrible risks. Without the exploitation of cheaper female labor, the British government could not have created the vast networks of surveillance that yielded hundreds of thousands of pages detailing the activities of enemy aliens, domestic dissidents, and suspected spies between 1914 and 1918. In short, the modern system of counterespionage and secrecy in Britain was built and organized partly through the labor of women employed during the Great War. My work investigates the complicated relationship between the state and its disenfranchised women in a charged atmosphere of wartime secrecy and militarism. Although reluctant at first to use women, either in Britain or abroad, intelligence offices had to recruit women to make its war effort, surveillance, foreign information gathering, information processing possible. Since the First World War, the dual image of women intelligence workers has continued. Clerks, such as Miss Moneypenny, vie with the Bond girls in the James Bond movies, for instance. Still present is the pervasive myth, represented by the enduring image of Mata Hari, that women who do serve as active intelligence agents rely on their sexuality to gain access to secrets. Ian Fleming in Moonraker, from 1955, elaborated on this idea, suggesting that women in intelligence work place themselves in perpetual concubinage to king and country. This myth of the sexualized female spy replicates long-held assumptions about women's unreliability and their need to resort to feminine wiles in order to prize secrets from weak men. Both stereotypes, the clerk and the seductress, should be nuanced. From the origins of MI5 and MI6, nearly 100 years ago, women have played a role in gathering and analysis of the nation's vital intelligence. Nearly 800 women staffed the first card registry that recorded and tracked subversive activity in Britain during World War I. And unusual women, such as Gertrude Bell, even served as officers in British intelligence. In Bell's case, as an important player in the Arab Bureau, founded in 1916, alongside such well-known figures as Lawrence of Arabia. Female searchers worked at British ports to try to identify women passengers who might have something to hide from wartime authorities. Women even gathered intelligence behind enemy lines in World War I, working as soldiers, not seductresses, using their invisibility and male attitudes toward women to their advantage. Most British spy networks in Europe were in occupied zones of Belgium, Luxembourg, and northern France. Individual women who led intelligence or escape networks put their lives on the line. For instance, Louise de Bettigny ran the Alice service under the codename Alice Dubois. Described by British officials as a regular Joan of Arc, she began her work disguised as a nun at a convent in Lille. She received pieces of a wireless, which was then assembled for her to receive transmissions. Caught in October 1915, when Germans discovered the wireless, Louise swallowed the report she was carrying. She was imprisoned and died in prison. Many of these individuals were treated like martyrs after the war. Belgian agent Gabriel Petit was described as a soldier, a modest soldier, but a stubborn soldier with a will of iron, always ready to submit to torture for the honor of her flag. Perhaps one female spy who survived the war said it best. Soldiers without uniforms, we have not known the intoxication of combat where we advanced elbow to elbow to the seductive clarion call, nor the knights of battle triumphant. But we have known violent struggle. We have done our duty as good British soldiers, and we have done it with joy, with no other hope but the assurance that our modest services would not be unnecessary to the great common cause. In short, the best female spies were not glamorous seductresses, but instead they were shopkeepers, teachers, housewives, students. The more invisible they were, the better able they were to hide their roles as spies. Certainly there were female agents working for British intelligence who were prostitutes, And there are records of women who were paid in cash or drugs for information, especially in garrison and border towns near the front lines and occupied zones. However, these women's lives were typically far from glamorous, and their willingness to spy for the British was often a signal of their desperation. The best-known spy seductress, Mata Hari, was an exotic dancer and courtesan in the pre-war period who agreed to spy for both France and Germany during the war, but she was by no means successful, again giving lie to the idea that women spies could only be useful if gathering information in intimate settings. Another complicating factor in matters of female loyalty was British nationality law that tied women's citizenship to that of their husbands until 1948. Women, then, were doubly suspect as both sexual beings and as accidental citizens, tied to the state only through the nationality of the men with whom they were intimate. Since the First World War, many of these early assumptions about female intelligence work have remained in place, but perhaps things are beginning to change in the world of intelligence. Scholarly work on the agents of Britain's Special Operations Executive in the Second World War chronicles the bravery of female field agents who worked behind enemy lines to organize resistance to the Nazis. Many of them sacrificed their lives for this work. Their chief, Vera Atkins, survived the war to bear witness to the role of women as foot soldiers and directors of intelligence work in occupied Europe. More recent examples of successful female intelligence agents have also emerged in the media and in popular imagination, eroding some of the stereotypes of the past. Dame Stella Remington, the first female director of MI5, demonstrated through her career that women could succeed in the field and in managerial positions in the security services. In her memoir about life at MI5, she does mention the pervasive culture of gender discrimination in the agency. Perhaps in a nod to Remington, the James Bond franchise has replaced its chief with a female in the form of Dame Judi Dench, who physically resembles Stella Remington. Finally, the unmasking of Melina Norwood, the so-called granny spy of the atomic age in Britain, has also called into question assumptions about female spies as vamps. Norwood, an ordinary secretary living in the London environs, was exposed in 1999 as a former spy for the Soviets. Over her 40-year espionage career, she easily passed technical atomic secrets to the USSR and was not caught until well after the end of the Cold War when she was in her 80s. Today, intelligence agencies have begun slowly to reconsider their need for women's work in all aspects of intelligence gathering and analysis. A good example of the changing world of espionage is a speech in July 2012 by Nick Warner, head of Australia's Secret Intelligence Service. Warner noted that nearly half of his agency's spies were women, many of them with skills in multiple languages and from mixed ethnic backgrounds. This year, CIA Director David Petraeus began a zero-tolerance policy in regard to sexual harassment in the U.S. agency. These changes, while slow in coming, point to a new world where women in intelligence work no longer will be stereotyped as concubines or courtesans, but as valuable national security assets. Thank you.
Wittenberg University Professor Tammy Proctor on the myth of the female spy. That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. Thanks to all of our guests, and thank you for listening. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.